summer of 2024, moving much too quickly for my liking. And I know that's a bit odd to say because summer just started, what, less than a week ago officially. But I, like most people, consider the start of summer to be late May on Memorial Day weekend, which is now a month ago. Where does the time go? But what is to my liking is having the opportunity to spend some time together in this wonderful arena that we've collectively created known as the Far Middle. I am Nick DeOlius, your host, and just to remind you, in case you're new to the podcast, we publish weekly episodes. They typically get to the point and last under half an hour in duration. The format mimics and honors the format of Dr. James Burke's creation from late 1970s and early 1980s BBC television, the science and history documentary Connections. So each Far Middle connects a series of topics, much like Dr. Burke did with his brilliant creation of Connections. It's worked quite well, now in our fourth year, and I think you'll enjoy it as much as the rest of our audience does, which we lovingly reference as our constant listeners. And if this podcast doesn't fulfill your desire for the types of issues that we cover, we do offer other platforms for your viewing and consumption pleasure. I'm active on social media, specifically X and LinkedIn and Facebook, and you can find me on all those with the Nick DeOlius moniker and handle. And I publish regularly on my website, nickdeolius.com. You can also find archived Far Middle episodes on the personal website. Oh, and there is a YouTube channel, Nick DeOlius, adding material on a regular basis. Subscribe to the YouTube channel or follow me on X or LinkedIn or sign up for our email distributions on the nickdeolius.com website to the extent that you wish on any of those. The sports dedication is another person who I can't believe has escaped being a dedication subject through 160 plus episodes of the Far Middle. What was I thinking? Yeah, we've got another wrong that we're going to have to right. And this episode's premiere date is June 26th, and on the 26th of June in 1970, the great Frank Robinson hit back-to-back grand slams in the fifth and sixth innings in the Orioles' 12-2 victory over the Washington Senators. And by the way, the same runners were on base both times, which is interesting. Now, recognize Frank Robinson wasn't just one of the greatest of his generation, but one of the all-time greats. His stats prove it. His two World Series titles, two MVPs, one in each league, by the way, his Triple Crown, they all prove it. No need to go into that. Either you know or you can look it up. And he was an intimidator on the field. Everyone acknowledges that Bob Gibson, a prior Far Middle dedication subject, was the epitome of intimidator on the mound as a pitcher during the 1960s and 70s. Well, in many ways, Frank Robinson was the batting equivalent, the answer to Gibson during that era. Nasty disposition. And wish I could have seen those two going at it as a pitcher batter. Instead, though, I want to, as we've been doing for probably the past 30 episodes or so with our sports dedications, I want to focus on Robinson beyond the diamond, or at least as a player, and how he lived a well-rounded life. There's lessons there for all of us. He was one of 10 kids who moved from Texas to the Bay Area in California. How about this? He played basketball as a kid with Bill Russell, and he played baseball as a kid with Kirk Flood. He was a superstar in the National League with the Reds and then a superstar in the American League with the Orioles. And he became a player manager in Cleveland and was the first black manager in MLB history. Managed over 2,000 games, by the way. Worked in the front office of teams, worked for the front office of Major League Baseball, and worked on TV. And while in Baltimore, he became active in the civil rights movement, and he originally declined membership in the NAACP unless the organization promised not to make him do public appearances. However, after witnessing Baltimore's segregated housing and discriminatory real estate practices, he reconsidered and became an enthusiastic speaker on racial issues. Now, great achievers sometimes are lucky enough to have a statue built in their honor. Frank Robinson has three statues in three cities that he positively impacted: Cincinnati, Baltimore, and Cleveland, as a baseball player, a manager, an executive, and a civil rights activist. Thus, we proudly erect our virtual Far Middle statue to the great Frank Robinson. Okay, so there have been more than a few constant listeners over the past, I would say, year or so, who've asked an interesting question of your host. And that question pertained to whether or not I use AI, something like ChatGPT, to prepare content and episodes of The Far Middle. Well, the answer, in case you're interested, is absolutely not. That would be like Frank Robinson cheating with a corked bat. I shun AI tools partly because I haven't invested enough time to fully understand the capabilities of tools like ChatGPT, but also and primarily because I am of the opinion that content such as this, along with art and music and literature, should be created by the human and not by the technology or the bot or the neural network. And I'm not against any of those. As an engineer, I'm pro-technology. But in the world of The Far Middle, the only way it works from my perspective is for it to come from one mind to another, human to human. Speaking of AI, we can ease into another connection which speaks to a very intriguing dilemma that is found with our modern economy. Throughout the United States, there is a rising new economy of data centers to feed AI. You've probably heard about it. And data centers are popping up across mid-sized cities all over the country, particularly in the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic regions. Now, some call it the advanced manufacturing economy. Some label it as just AI. But we know two things for certain, no matter what label you attach to it. First, it represents the next chapter and new frontier and a major avenue of growth for both economy and the tech sector. Second, the success of building this new opportunity to drive the new economy hinges on one crucial input: reliable and affordable, uninterruptible power or electricity. The appetite of data centers for power is voracious, and it results in massive power demand growth requests. At the same time, the utility industry and its grids have been eroded and weakened by climate regulations that forced retirement and abandonment of the reliable and low cost and replaced it with mandates for the intermittent and expensive, which haven't been able to consistently scale efficiently. So the new economy is requiring a massive increase in the supply of reliable and affordable electricity, while energy policy under the badge of climate alarmism has eroded the safety margins, capacities, cost effectiveness, and reliability of grids where the data centers are popping up. This creates a conflict between the tech sector and environmentalists, which is quite ironic because for years the tech industry enabled and fed the radical environmental movement. Now the movement shows its appreciation by stunting the growth of its enabler. And a good example of this tension is found in Virginia and Georgia, where data centers are sprouting up everywhere and the demand for power has exploded. Georgia Power, which is the main utility in Georgia, has boosted its demand projections by 1,600%, 16-fold increase. And it knows that there is no way to meet that new demand projection without increasing utilization of reliable and affordable generation sources such as natural gas. And when the radical environmental movement hears that, it freaks and makes false and baseless claims. It wrongly says costs will go up and that the planet will boil even more and sooner because of the increased utilization of natural gas. So you see the conflict. The tech industry wants the power, and it wants it now to feed its next generation of opportunity, while the radical environmental movement desires power use to sharply decline and the cost of power to significantly increase under the justification of code red and climate alarmism. Experts in the data center industry sum up the importance of reliable and affordable electricity quite well with the quip that we find the guys with the fastest power win. Yeah, this situation is popping up all across the country, not just in Georgia and Virginia. U.S. power usage is projected to expand by almost 5% over the next 5 years, which compares to a previous estimate of only around 2.5%. So almost a doubling. Energy experts say that they haven't seen such change in power demand in decades, and the utility and power sector forgot how to deal with load growth at these levels. Yes, energy and climate policies purposely weakened the grid, and now the real-world economy is demanding a heightened level of both grid supply and reliability. Something's got to give. But what I love about this quandary is that it highlights the folly of the climate alarmist agenda. The energy transition is not going to be free, pursuing its policies will not be painless, and the climate alarmist agenda necessarily requires surrendering just about any and all significant growth opportunities in our economy moving forward. Because all those opportunities, including AI and data centers, They require reliable and affordable energy. You cannot adopt draconian net zero plans and climate alarmism ideology, and at the same time hope to be able to grow the data center and AI economy at an efficient pace, mutually exclusive under the laws of math and physics. Now, the tech industry, it's starting to squirm. So tech executives one day, they state they demand their power providers go green and that they have net zero commitments and that they believe an economy can function purely on wind and solar. And then the following day, they sign a contract to get them the much needed reliable and affordable power for their data centers or AI businesses that will be fueled by natural gas. And then the following day after that, when pushed on the two contradicting days, the executive dances around the issue, saying that not every project itself has to be zero carbon or reduce carbon emissions, but that overall the goal can be achieved, which is absolute nonsense. But assuming that wind and solar are zero carbon emitters is also a fairy tale fiction. We've discussed it many times on the Far Middle. A modern economy absolutely needs carbon to function efficiently. There is no zero carbon way to run such an economy, because all forms of electricity and all economic activity that carry a carbon footprint, including and especially things like wind, solar, and electric vehicles. And now, as we have just discussed, AI and data centers. The demand for fossil fuels, constant listeners, isn't declining, and it certainly isn't going to zero. It's going to increase, and that's something that we should be happy about. It sums up what happens when the reality collides with the ideology. Let's jump into the next connection that speaks about the effort to indoctrinate the next generation with the ideology. And we'll use as an example not Georgia, but we'll head north to the Garden State or New Jersey. The governor of New Jersey is all in when it comes to Code Red. Governor stated a desire to make New Jersey a leader in the fight against climate change, and he was going to steer the state toward a green economy, whatever that means. He's announced plans to achieve a 100% clean energy grid by 2035. By increasing the state's reliance on offshore wind. And that's not good news for the whales, because it's been shown the construction of offshore wind is killing endangered whales. And wind is far from clean when you look at its supply chain realities. But anyway, that doesn't deter the governor. And oh yeah, here is also the mandate that by 2035, all new cars and trucks that are sold within the state, they must be zero emission vehicles, meaning electric vehicles. But of course, those aren't zero emission, more fiction on top of fiction. And the state is also making sure kids in the next generation are fully indoctrinated with radical environmental ideology. New Jersey's been integrating climate change into its primary and high school science curriculum for 10 years. And in recent years, New Jersey's become the first state to incorporate climate change into all school subjects, not just science. Now, all public school districts in the state are required to teach and test students in every grade about climate change. That includes core curriculum, such as science, computer technology, world languages, social studies, art, and even gym class. And here's how ridiculous these standards are. Districts are encouraged to incorporate climate change into English and math instruction. The state provides sample lesson plans to teachers and districts to illustrate how they can highlight climate change in class, or constantly pound students with the message that New Jersey is suffering the worst impacts of global warming. In history class, students will be required to explain how fossil fuels are a source of conflict here and abroad. If a student has taken a foreign language, they'll be asked to discuss the impact of climate change on the target language region in the world that they are studying. And then in the performing arts, students are encouraged to use climate change to, and I'm using the exact words here, provided by the state, inform original dances expressed through multiple genres, styles, and varied cultural perspectives. Wow. New Jersey public schools are now religious institutions, and the religion is that of radical environmentalism and climate alarmism. The focus on indoctrination in public education comes at a massive price, and perhaps conveniently covers over a generational crisis. Because students are not taught the basics of math, science, and reading, and they're not learning life skills. Educators in the system, they're too busy obsessing about indoctrinating students with those favored ideologies. And we can demonstrate that with connections to a couple of unpleasant and extremely disturbing statistics. And let's start by staying in New Jersey. Since the current governor took office, student proficiency rates in English, math, and science, they declined sharply across all grade levels in all those subjects. New Jersey student proficiency levels have not come close to recovering to where they were before pandemic and before the current governor took office. And to top it off, the state has lowered the passing score of its high school exit exam so that the statistics will show that more seniors graduated. Form over substance, ideology over reality, the new mottos of New Jersey's public education system. But here's even more troubling statistics when you zoom out the nationwide. As we see time and again, the demographic that pays the heaviest price for these distractions like climate alarmism within education, they're going to be the poorest. As of 2019, two-thirds of African-American 12th graders did not possess even partial mastery of basic 12th grade math. And that's defined as being able to do arithmetic and to read a graph. Only 7% of African-American 12th graders were proficient in 12th grade math, which is defined as being able to calculate using ratios. And the number who are advanced in math was so small, it didn't show up statistically in the national data. Pretty much the same story in reading competency. Half of African-American 12th grade students didn't possess even partial mastery of basic reading, and only 4% were advanced. These statistics, they never fail to infuriate. We're assigning a generation to unrealized potential. We're dooming them to a life unfulfilled. And for what and why? Well, we know the answers. To instead have the system serve desires of special interests who could not care less about the quality of life and future prospects of millions of Americans. Do we care about our kids? Sometimes I wonder. Kids in our public education system, they're not the only ones betrayed by the system and its leadership. While New Jersey focuses on indoctrinating students with climate ideology, we can make a quick connection to talk about how 12 million Catholics in China are being betrayed by the leader of the Catholic faith, Pope Francis, who happens to buy in wholeheartedly to climate alarmism. While he focuses on preaching the Code Red religion and vilifies America publicly, he covers up and avoids discussing how the Catholic Church is being preempted by another, more powerful ideology, communism and the CCP and President Xi. The Catholic Church has been in the gun sights of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, for some time. Communism looks to eradicate all religions other than that of the left, and China's CCP is no different. And one of the ways the CCP attacks the Catholic Church in China is by refusing to respect who the Pope anoints as bishops in China. Instead, the CCP itself selects bishops for Chinese dioceses. Pope Benedict in 2007 saw this danger and called China's unilateral appointment of Catholic bishops as, quote, one of the most delicate problems, end quote, in Vatican-Chinese relations. And there was a provisional agreement between the Vatican and China in 2018. This is about 6 years ago. That was supposed to solve all of this. The Vatican presents the agreement as a remarkable achievement that will further the long journey toward what they call communion and unity with China's bishops. But then there is the reality. Under Pope Francis's leadership, the Vatican surrenders more and more to China and the CCP simply to keep the optics of a good relationship alive. The Chinese government appoints bishops on its own, and now the Pope gives his after-the-fact blessing to these CCP appointments as a routine hollow gesture. It's an embarrassing act of desperation. It's bad enough that the Catholic Church and the Pope have been immorally silent when it comes to criticizing the human rights abuses of the CCP. Consider that Catholic bishops all over the world are instructed to refrain from speaking publicly about China's abuse. Again, the best word for that is immoral. Sadly, from what is supposed to be a moral institution. Now you wonder why we need a Vatican at all. Well, check that, because you still need the Vatican to criticize the United States and Americans. Please. And this ties to a common adherence to the religion of climate change. Check out this quote from one of the leaders of the Vatican under Pope Francis. I see a lot of things happening that would really open many doors because President Xi and his government are concerned about things that Pope Francis is concerned about, especially the ecology. Yeah, another Vatican leader under the Pope praises China for representing the best at implementing the social doctrine of the church, and that both China and the Vatican defend the dignity of the person. Wow. And if you happen to be Catholic clergy in China, you're forced by the government to spread CCP principles, implement CCP values, echo President Xi's thoughts, and get this, prohibit minors from attending church. Yeah, but Pope Francis, he's still convinced there's much to be gained through dialogue with the CCP and pursuing friendship with it. And you thought Neville Chamberlain was bad. By the way, much of this is based on a degree of speculation because that 2018 agreement between the Vatican and the CCP, it's been kept secret. Nobody knows what it specifically says for certain. But we know that the Pope was supposed to have a veto over appointed bishops from the CCP. But all indications are that the Pope doesn't even have a veto with the current situation. About half of the appointments in China since the 2018 agreement have been made without papal involvement. But Pope Francis and the Vatican leadership, they continue to toe the line of the Chinese Communist Party. A Chinese bishop, one approved by the CCP, recently went on record stating the following. We must adhere to the principle of independence and autonomy in running the church, adhering to the principle of democracy in running the church, and adhere to the direction of sinicization of the Catholic Church in China. This is the bottom line, which no one can break, and it is also a high-pressure line, which no one should touch. Now, that is a chilling quote. China's bishops, they also have to join what's known as the Patriotic Association, which requires mandatory pledges of independence from foreign influences, which the Catholic Church would certainly be viewed as. That's right, Chinese bishops have to pledge independence from the Catholic Church. And the Vatican permits clergy to join the association. The Vatican pretends the independence only applies to political parties and not religions. Yeah, right. The Vatican propaganda continues, showing the depths of its denial. It says that the 2018 deal with the Chinese Communist Party is working well, and that it was a remarkable step forward, and it praises it for unifying the church and creating an environment where, quote, both sides recognize the Pope as the supreme leader of the bishops, end quote. Come on, Pope. As we close the episode this week, let's reflect on a connection to all that discussion we just had on temperatures with climate change and math with New Jersey student math competencies and the Pope looking to subvert science. Today, June 26th, marks the birthday of a great man. I'm confident you won't recognize it first. William Thomson was his name. He was one of the foremost scientists and engineers of his age in the 1800s. Born in Belfast, Thomson studied at Cambridge before becoming a professor at Glasgow University, where he remained for 50 years. He published more than 600 scientific papers back then when it was truly science in such papers. And his most famous was where he proposed an absolute scale of temperature, now called the Kelvin scale. And some of you out there in the engineering and chemistry worlds know what I'm talking about. Absolute zero, anyone? Thomson became famous to the public through his involvement in the laying of the transatlantic telegraph cable in the 1850s and 1860s. So he served basically as a founding father connection to the artificial intelligence industry of today, which we also discussed. He was knighted by Queen Victoria, and he became Lord Kelvin. Thus, the Kelvin scale got its name. William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, is buried in Westminster Abbey. Good to end on a science history connection that Dr. James Burke would be proud of. Have a great week, everybody.